Thank you, Stefan. And thank you very much for inviting me to come from California. I'm very happy to be here. I'm sorry I don't speak German, but I know many of you speak English. So I just want to start and give you a little story and background about me, because as Stefan said, I've been a journalist actually for 45 years. I started at the New York Times in 1970, after I graduated from university, as what was called then a copy boy. But if you think about what a copy boy is or was, I was the internet. Because in the old model, the copy boy, and there were very few women actually in those days, moved information around the newsroom. And there was an in-basket and an out-basket, and the best copy boys ran very fast. And you moved information. But it was all about moving information. And really, what we're doing here today is we're all moving information, but in very different ways. But the other thing that happened to me at the New York Times as a very young man was that I was actually part of the what was called the Pentagon Papers, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, which was probably one of the most important stories any newspaper did in the United States or the world in the late 20th century. It was the secret history of the Vietnam War. But I literally got a phone call at home one night from one of the editors of the Times, and he said, come to room 1111 at the Hilton Hotel tomorrow. Don't tell anybody where you're going, not even your mother, and bring enough clothes for a month. And the next morning, I went to the Hilton Hotel, and I walked into the suite of rooms where the Times had moved their editors and reporters because it was top secret. And if you all understand what Snowden had, the New York Times had hundreds of thousands of words and thousands of pages of top secret documents. And the first question the editor said to me, he said, if you don't want to get arrested, leave right now. And I looked at him, and I said, what? And I was 22 years old. It was the height of the Vietnam War. America was in a huge state of crisis. And that night, I was Xeroxing in the publisher's office after midnight, because they sent me over after the building closed, on a huge Xerox machine that was about 12 feet long with green light emanating out of it. And I thought I was going to be sterilized. I'm not. I have three children. But I was looking at documents that said, for your eyes only, top secret, Henry Cabot Lodge to President Kennedy. And it was the first things I looked at were about the US's complicity in the assassination of his new brothers, Diem, which happened in 1967 in Vietnam. But that was a formulation for my entire career, because I immediately understood that government always didn't tell the truth, that the press really mattered, and the press's role in a democracy was to stand up to the worst abuses. And after 45 years, I'm now running an organization. It's a very pure organization in a sense. It's a public service organization. But how did I get there? I ended up having a very good career in journalism. I was a foreign correspondent. I did investigative reporting. I spent most of my career at a very good newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, that's now been gutted. And I eventually became the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And if any of you are journalists who started out your career as a reporter or as a messenger and ended up running an organization, you realize you're not really trained to do that. I'm a journalist, I'm a storyteller, and I eventually got fired as the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer in 2001 because it was during the downsizing and the collapse of the legacy media model in the United States, which I think it was ahead of what's happened in Europe. But what really happened was that the Philadelphia Inquirer was part of an organization called Knight Ridder, which owned 32 newspapers in the United States and was a $6 billion company. It doesn't exist today. It's gone. And what was happening as the internet started was obvious that the audience was shifting, the business model was changing, and what I found was that the business side had absolutely no stomach or interest in changing or evolving, because the first question that was always asked when I wanted to do something differently was what will it cost and what's the revenue? And when you're operating in that environment, it's really difficult to innovate and change. There's nothing wrong with making profit or revenue. It supports the journalism. But what the corporate media in the United States did was think about the only way to manage the drop in profit and revenue was to cut. And who did they cut? The best journalists. The Inquirer had about 650 journalists in the newsroom when I was there, and by the time I got fired, it was down to 150. But the thing that really I pushed back on was that they wanted the most talented and best journalists to leave because they were paid the most, and they made it very lucrative for them to leave. I ended up getting fired. I taught at Columbia at the journalism school, and I wasn't sure what I would do. I had many really interesting job offers outside journalism, but I decided I had one more newspaper in me, and I went to San Francisco to be the managing editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. I didn't get fired there, but I left after 4 years because I was completely frustrated by the inability of corporate media to think differently and try new things. So in 2007, after I left the Chronicle, I was asked by something called the Columbia Journalism Review, which is a very well-known media magazine in the United States that comes out of Columbia University, to write something about the future of journalism. And I wrote this 8 years ago, and I think it's highly relevant today. I'm just going to read you a few paragraphs from what I wrote, because this is really what I think we all should be doing still. The crucial element determining success in the future will be the strength of emerging relationships among those whose money will support the journalistic enterprise and those who create the product. They will need to arrive at a sense of shared values and passion about what their journalistic enterprise is and the values it holds, not expressed in monetary terms alone. To use the term news organization does not begin to describe the potential opportunities I see ahead for these new ventures. Publishing partnerships will be formed in collaboration among news organizations, though these might look very different than we think of to them today, will be crucial. Creating these organizations using a new DNA will be easier than the slow transition we are witnessing today with the old model organization. Energy increases when we become engaged in building something new instead of feeling demoralized as institutions we once valued so highly are being destroyed by our own cannibalization. I have faith that new models of journalism are going to fly out of this whirlpool of change and be successful. I wrote this in 2007. 10 years ago, Google wasn't even in our vocabulary. Craigslist and Facebook and MySpace and YouTube, we didn't know about. Journalism as practice at newspapers is not dead, but journalists will need to salvage what is essential, figure out how to transform it into the new media and become leaders in this period of upheaval. It will take men and women of vision and deep pockets whose primary catalyst is not profit. As journalists, we live in a time of crisis, offering the possibilities of historic change as we witness a pillar of our democracy being wounded and withering away. Great urgency and risk-taking is called for to stem the collapse of what newspapers has stood for in our country's past. We have no other choice. It's interesting to me when I read that today, I don't even mention, 8 years ago, Twitter and Facebook. So it's just the acceleration has continued. So when I came to CIR is the oldest nonprofit journalism organization in the United States. It was founded in 1977. I became the executive director in January of 2008. CIR had 7 people. It was unclear it would survive. I had no idea how to raise money. In the United States, we have a strong tradition of philanthropy, which may be different from Europe, and actually a tiny percentage of American philanthropy does go to media. But I took this on as a mission of, I guess, passion and belief. And what I wanted to do was, and this is, when you go out and raise money, it is not easy, I can tell you that. But this is what I talked about doing, and it's 2008. With CIR, what I wanted to do, and the journalists here will immediately understand it, in the center of everything, if you think of a wheel, the center of everything is the story, is the data, is the information. I wanted to create an organization that, if you look at that wheel, had spokes. Each spoke, and you'd add spokes, would be a different platform. So in the center was the story. But how do you create an organization? Not only if the information is gathered by someone who's a print reporter, get that person to work with someone who can do an animation, a video, an audio, interactive data sets, you name it. And at that point, we did not have the mobile explosion we have today. But what we actually have done that. And since 2008, I've been able to raise over $40 million close to $50 million for CIR. Today we have 70 people. We've won nearly every journalism award you can win in the United States for innovation, for doing things differently, and for quality. Now, how did this happen? It's hard to describe really how it happened, and I never thought we'd have the success that we've had. But central to this model and why we've been able to fund it is we're not driven by revenue. We're not driven by profit. The people who give us money believe that journalism and investigative reporting are crucial in a democracy, is what I said. And they believe that one of the worst and first things that is attacked and undermined and destroyed historically by the worst governments are journalists and journalism. The challenging of authority through accurate and information and storytelling that challenges authority, whether it's corporate or government, the people who support us believe that's crucial. It is not a huge number of Americans, but there in America, we have really big foundations who give a lot of money away, and a tiny percentage of that money, less than 1% of American philanthropy, which is billions and billions and billions of dollars, less than 1% goes to media. But when I went around early on, and I was doing this in 2008 and 2009, which was even more difficult, it was the height of the recession. It was really hard to raise money. I didn't think we'd succeed. But the first tranche of funding we got was for doing storytelling in California, and it was called something called California Watch. And again, this was a really different model. If any of you, the journalists here, know about competition, we wanted to change the whole concept of competition. How did we do that? We had really good stories. So the first big story we did in California was about fraud and abuse in the Department of Homeland Security in the United States, which gives away, at that point, as the war was sort of winding down in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you've seen this happen in Ferguson, American police departments were getting tanks, they were getting, you know, missiles, they were getting, you name it. And how were they getting that? The Department of Homeland Security had, there was so much surplus weaponry in the United States, they were basically giving it to police departments. The story we did, this is how we started. I would call up an editor of a newspaper in California and say, we have a really good story. And some of them knew me, and I'd explain, oh, we want that story. I'd say, oh, by the way, you're going to have to pay us something. What? You're a nonprofit. I said, just give us $100, $200. We have to get some money. And by the way, it's not going to be exclusive. I don't want it then. I said, okay, you don't have to have it. And then the guy would call me back and said, you know, we'll take that story. The first story we did in California was on 28 newspaper front pages on the same day. It was broadcast across the state on radio through the public radio network, and it was on 5 television stations in the 5 biggest markets. That story reached about 5 million people. It was astonishing. And the next day and the day after that, I started getting phone calls from editors around California. It's a, you know, 40 million people live there. And they said, why weren't we part of this? And I'm on the phone, I said, this is gonna work. Why aren't we part of this? They were upset that because what happened is it got a huge amount of tension because of the distribution in the story and because no one had done it before. And that was in 2009. We began to take off. Because not because of the model, which really worked, but because we did really good stories and stories that no one else is doing. So the central idea was all that wheel and all the different ideas, but nothing we've done would succeed without journalism. Now, here's the other thing that's really crucial to our model, which is very different. We're not rewarded for audience. We're not rewarded for all the innovation, though we do get some of it. We are rewarded for impact. The people who fund us believe that journalism that makes a difference, as I said a few times, is crucial in democracy. We're not partisan, we're not political, but we do very tough stories that drive change. When we do a story that President Obama cites, that is like $1 billion in revenue. Or some US senator, whether he's a Democrat or Republican, stands up in the Senate and says, this story by the Center for the Investigative Reporting is an outrage. How did this happen? That is a huge win for us. When laws change, when people's thinking changes, when we go to a community and they have a big meeting about a story we did because they weren't aware of an issue, this is really important. This doesn't happen by magic. We've created an organization where when you start planning a big story or thinking about an investigative story, it's not just the journalists who are sitting down at the table. We have social media people, we have distribution people, and the process is incredibly collaborative internally and externally. This is really different. I ran a newsroom with 650 people. If I wanted the city editor who covered Philadelphia to collaborate and work with the features editor on a story, I would have to bring them in a room and bang their heads together because everybody said, my reporter is busy, my reporter's busy. I would have situations, if any of you ran a newspaper, where the business editor would get really mad at me because they were doing a story for their business section, and I would say it should go on the front page. He'd say, what's going to go in my section? Some of you may have had that conversation. So the internal dynamic was really culturally driven by exclusivity, by what's mine, and people didn't want to work together. And I saw that that really wasn't going to work in a new model. So when you create the new newsrooms, which I alluded to in what I wrote in 2007, it was really about people working together in a different way. If you came to our newsroom, you would have that frequently someone who's come out of print, who's a very strong reporter, working with a 24-year-old kid who's going to turn their story into an animation. If you imagine the conversation the first time, a really deeply reported, fact-based story by some reporter who's 60 years old is going to say, my story's going to become an animation? Are you kidding me? Well, we've done it. Now, why do you do that? Imagine doing a story about juvenile solitary confinement in the United States, and I don't know if it occurs in Germany, where you cannot get in and really show somebody what it's like to be locked up for 300 days when you haven't even committed a crime because you're a poor kid from the ghetto in New York, and you're taken to Rikers Island, and you're charged with something, and you can't afford a lawyer, and you sit there, and your first day in prison, you're wearing nice sneakers, and somebody grabs your sneakers, and you punch them, and you get put in juvenile solitary confinement for 300 days. How do you tell that story? You can tell it the way I just told it. So what we've done, though, imagine being in a newsroom where you find that kid after he's been released, and you sit down, and you take him his story on audio, and you film it, but you can't get in the cell. How do you really describe what that's like? You have his words. So we did a cartoon. We did an animation. It's called The Box. It's gotten huge attention. When The Box came out, you know what we did? We got a rapper to do the music to it. So guess what happened to that thing? When it appeared on rap digital, on internet websites all around the United States, it got huge attention, not because we did the story, but because we brought in a rapper to use the background music. So when Mos Def, I'm not sure how many of you heard of Mos Def, I didn't, was used in that thing, we were thinking, and I didn't do any of that, the staff said, who is the audience? Where is the audience here? So it was not just politicians and the people who ran the prison system in New York State. That story was also told and broadcast nationally on public television. It was in newspapers around the United States. There was a text story, and there was that animation. But the thing that went viral was the animation, because we used a rapper as background music. And when we did that story, the precision of it was astonishing. The reporters found a former guard at Rikers Island in New York who was the prison photographer. Somehow they found him. I don't even know how. They went to his house, and he showed them pictures of the cells that people were in, the solitary confinement cells. So if you watch The Box, the animation, the size of the bars, the bricks in the cell are exactly what they really look like. Exactly the same. So the values and standards of really high quality journalism and information and storytelling were applied to an animation. It worked. I mean, so it's a really different way to think about what you're doing. But if you're open, if you look around this room, how many people here are under 30? You don't have to raise your hands. But in your newsrooms, you have to have kids. You have to have digital natives. You have to have somebody and the people who understands the way Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all these things work to think about, I'm going to tell the story and distribute it in a completely different way. Part of the reason we've been raised all that money is that we do things differently. We won something called the MacArthur Award a few years ago. Some of you may be familiar with the MacArthur Genius Award, which is given in the United States by the MacArthur Foundation. They give it to individuals. They give them $600,000 to $700,000 to use it for whatever they want. I got a phone call one day from MacArthur, and they said, so-and-so, this is so-and-so from the MacArthur Foundation. And they said, you've won the Mackie. It's a different name. They give it to nonprofits. I didn't even know there was this award. And I go, oh, thank you very much. And by the way, you're getting $1 million. So that was a good phone call. But why did we get it? We got it. They expect us to do the journalism, but what they really loved, not only did we do animations, we work with spoken word poets. We did a story in Richmond, California, where we used spoken word poets. They came into our office, three young African-American kids who never probably read a newspaper in their life or watched television news, with dreadlocks. And they came in, and we sat them down, and we let them actually told them about the story and said, we want you to try something. Will you guys do a poem, a performance, a rap? You do it. And they looked at us, they looked at each other, and they said, sure. A young white woman, they lived in Richmond, California, one of the poorest places in California. It's right next to San Francisco, the land of plenty. And they lived, and the story was about a housing project that was completely corrupt, malfeasance, you'd get the story. But the reporter who'd been reporting, we wanted to humanize the story. I mean, every deeply reported fact-based story has to have characters, and you all know that. The characters, you have to create empathy. Empathy drives connection, and it creates change. So we took these young men. They had never been in these projects. They went through these projects with this young white reporter. They were stunned. But when that story came out, and it was in the newspapers in San Francisco, it was on public radio, there was a nationally broadcast video about it. But when the poets who were in that community, when they did their performance, all hell broke loose because that story had credibility. It led to huge changes. The buildings were shut down. People were arrested. But when we did that performance in San Francisco, it was stunningly good. And if you can imagine working with three young men and having their poems not only fact checked, but read by a First Amendment lawyer for libel issues, that was a really interesting thing. Even our tweets are reviewed by lawyers in terms of the sensitivity. Now, all of this may sound really crazy, but it fits to our model because what happens in the States is, as I said, we're rewarded for the journalism and the impact. We have a social scientist on staff, a PhD social scientist. She's an impact analyst. We analyze everything. We created a job that almost didn't exist in any newsroom, a social scientist impact analyst, which we got funding for. We now, our number one source of non-philanthropic revenue is from consulting about how to teach other media organizations to measure and track the impact, and also have their journalists and reporters understand that making a difference is really crucial to sustainability. So we're in a very, and as I said earlier, a pure place, because if you're a journalist at CIR, you know that you have to do really good stories. But you're also told that it's not about advertising revenue, it's not even about audience, it's about doing journalism and doing stories that we can show make a difference. So if you're a journalist and you believe in doing that kind of reporting, investigative reporting, public service journalism, it's a really different place to be. Now, I'm not saying we figured this out, that we have the answer. It's working for now. Running a nonprofit and raising money for a nonprofit is really hard. Our budget next year will be about $9 million. As I said, we have 65 to 70 people. We've had to keep zigzagging like a startup because we never know from year to year are we going to have full funding. So we've changed a lot. Being nimble and being able to change, if you think about your organizations and how you're thinking about mobile technology and how you're going to tell stories and reach that mobile audience, is completely different than the way you were thinking 3 or 4 years ago. And it's only going to get bigger. The mobile devices, the technology, the ability for people to receive information and be their self-publishing is completely changed. What we call on-demand information is exploding in the United States. I was talking to Stefan a little bit yesterday or this morning about podcasts. Podcasts are exploding in the U.S. More people are now, they're moving away from radio, and it's on-demand. So we now have created our biggest audience-used content is a podcast. And it's not news, it's storytelling. One thing I haven't talked a lot about here today is storytelling. Everything is based on really good storytelling. Narrative storytelling, people will listen to, they will read, whether it's a 90-second video clip or a 45-minute documentary, it really comes down to the ability to tell stories. What we call the essence of our findings sometimes are written in a very tight, small way, and then there's a story, and the stories need to be character-driven. Why do we do plays? We actually have raised money around doing plays. We take deeply reported, fact-based investigative stories, and we do plays. Now, that may sound crazy, but we recently finished a play in San Francisco. A couple gave us $120,000 to turn one of our stories into a play. That's revenue. And why do you do that? Because they believed in art and they believe in journalism. Now, again, if you go in your news organization and take your best, most experienced reporter who's done a terrific story and say, by the way, we want you to turn your story into a play, they're not going to be happy. They're going to think you're crazy. What do you mean? Because what you're doing is taking the spine of the story, the data, the information, the facts, and then you're letting art take over. It's really complicated, but when you see it performed, we've had some of our reporters sitting in the audience watching a play with their sources, and sometimes these sources are family members who had a brother or a sister killed or murdered in an accident or in a crime, and they're seeing their brother or their sister or the characters brought to life on stage, and it's tricky. But I've seen a guy who won a Pulitzer Prize sitting next to the brother of a man who was murdered, whose neck was broken in a state hospital. He was severely autistic, and the caregiver broke his neck, sitting there and weeping, and then having the guy go up on stage and say, this makes my brother's death worthwhile because people are seeing what he was like and understanding what happened to him. We've had people come and the family members come and do these performances and then do talkbacks. When an audience comes and sees a play, if we did one of our plays here, you would be more engaged and more emotionally moved than probably any piece of content we create. That's difficult, but in the model we have at CIR, this is rewarded. So it's a really different kind of media organization. It's the creativity is what is awarded. The people who fund us expect us to do high quality, deeply fact-based, credible storytelling. And we're not just doing it on one platform. I mean, in the Q&A, you can ask me more if you like about how that happens, but it's what we do. And it's worked. And again, I'm not saying we have the answer, but I personally believe, and I've had a long career, as you heard, that this is probably the most creative period and the most important period. We are all overwhelmed by information. When I meet with Google people, they'll say to me, there's so much junk, and that's their word, and crap on the internet. I'm going to talk to them about how you surface and sustain and make sure that credible quality information and not entertainment is not only sustained but reaches an audience. This is a huge question for all of us. I mean, look at what's happening now in Europe, the American political campaign, we can talk about Donald Trump if you want, is insane. And the disinformation and the ability to distort and even lie and people begin to believe it is really terrifying. And as Germans, you understand that probably better than anybody. So we're at a moment now where this is all really interesting and entertaining, but we all have a responsibility to try and answer this. And the question of sustaining and maintaining and creating quality information that's fact-based and challenges some of the things going on is really crucial. I don't pretend here, standing here, we have the answer, but I think in this vortex of change, we're one of the places that's trying to do things differently. Thank you.